This is Radio Boston. I'm Anthony Brooks.
And I'm Meghna Chakrabarty. We're going to talk now about kids and learning and what advances in neuroscience say about both those things. And we'll start with a question. If a 7-year-old plays a certain logic game for an hour, a couple times a week, how much do you think it might improve her score on a test of reasoning? 5%? 10%? Maybe not at all?
Well, one MIT researcher found that in one high-poverty neighborhood, playing logic games boosted reasoning scores by 30%. It's just one of a batch of recent studies that point to just how changeable our brains really are.
And it hints at the possibility that certain games can change how children learn by changing how their brains work. The question is, do those temporary higher scores lead to lifelong gains in academic achievement? We'll talk with the MIT researcher we mentioned in just a moment, but let's begin with Ingrid Wickelgren, an editor at Scientific American Mind. She dove deep into this research for a cover story at the magazine this summer. She joins us now from New York. Ingrid Wickelgren, welcome to Radio Boston.
Thanks for having me.
So begin by explaining to us, for some time there has been emerging research about how certain sort of brain games may help people later in life. Everything from, a sophisticated set of games when, you're in your 70s or 80s to I try to play a crossword every now and then to maintain some sort of brain health. But why the new recent focus on brain games and kids and learning in particular? What drove that focus?
Well, I think some of the motivation for that is this, this research that suggests that certain fundamental capacities, certain thinking skills relating to memory and reasoning and speed of processing are actually changeable. And of course, what better sort of laboratory than a brain that's already developing? So there's sort of this some basic fundamental psychology that suggests that some of these functions, and there is part of them are termed executive functions, and we can come back to that, but that they're actually, it's actually possible to change them. Because we've sort of long considered, that when kids come to school, they all come with sort of a fixed set of capacities. We're not really trying to change how smart kids are in school. Schools traditionally geared toward teaching them knowledge and information and skills, all of which we've known to be possible and, of course, are also based on brain changes. But the fundamental sort of ability to learn has not really been considered changeable until recently.
Interesting. And it's interesting that it hasn't been considered changeable until recently because of what you just said a minute or so ago, that, I mean, we're talking about a period of a person's life where their brain is developing faster than it ever will later in life. So the changeability seems to be, just a matter of fact when you're young, isn't it?
Right. So an individual is going to change his or her ability to learn or is going to learn, right, over time. But what they didn't think was changeable is that, say, you take a kid who is sort of born with an inability to, learn math. Now, I mean, that's maybe an extreme, in an extreme case, you can take girls with Turner syndrome, which is a genetic condition that comes along with that, right? But there's probably a variation in children's ability in school, right? There are kids who are learning disabled, and it's not because of some thing we can point to. It's not because they weren't taught things, right? So there's a variation in that ability. And we thought that within an individual, it was very hard to take a learning disabled kid, for example, in a certain realm and fix that problem so that suddenly he can learn as fast as someone else who never had that problem. Now, I'm not saying that extreme case has actually happened, but that's where we're going here.
Okay, interesting. And what's underlying all of this is basically the new understanding or belief that environment in certain capacities can have a profound effect on the brain itself. So let me ask you, write in your article, Calisthenics for a Child's Mind, you give us several examples. And one is a particular capacity of the brain called working memory and games that are designed to improve working memory. Can you tell us, first of all, what working memory is and why is it so important?
Yes. Working memory is sort of a mental sketch pad. It's a temporary holding place for information, and we use it to solve a math problem. So if a math problem, we use it for many things, okay? We use it to read, to hold the individual words in mind so that we can then make sense of the sentence. We use it to hold different numbers in mind so that we can add them and subtract them. So that's what working memory is. And working memory has, in a number of studies, been linked very closely to IQ. So the greater your working memory capacity, the more likely it is that you're going to be a faster thinker, be able to do better on an IQ test.
Mm. And what are some of the studies, or one of the studies in particular, that tested ways to improve working memory in young people?
Right. So there's a computer program which is developed by a company called CogMed. It's now part of Pearson, that basically trains the ability to hold things in mind, sort of numbers in an array, or spaces, asteroids in outer space, or sequences of numbers. It's just a lot of practice. And That program has been shown to help kids, first of all, with attention deficit disorder, ADHD, to become, you know, it improves their attention. It improves their ability to stay on task. So there have been some small studies with these kids that have shown significant improvement on some of their learning abilities. There was also a study that took kids who were in the bottom sort of, I think, 5% or 10% in working memory skill, and were able to improve those kids' working memory. And then that actually translated into improvements on in math. So the studies, I mean, we don't really know exactly who all is going to benefit or how much they're going to benefit. But there's definitely data in peer-reviewed scientific journals that suggest that some of these programs do work. And the reason that they work, as opposed to just going to school, I think, is because they're very targeted at a specific type of capacity. And I think that may then translate into then you go into the classroom and then suddenly you have the ability to learn the material faster.
Well, there's a lot of questions I have about what we know or so far about long-term impacts here and learning as a whole for every student, and we'll get to those in a moment. But Ingrid Wickelgren, this is a point which I'm curious about. Do you have to play these games, I don't know, for 2 hours a day every day to see these effects? I mean, is it for the kids who have been parts of these studies, is it become a major part of their day, or is relatively little needed to produce these dramatic differences in testing that you've seen?
So generally, and in the working memory studies that I just mentioned, what they do is they practice them for about 35 to 40 minutes. And, you know, it helps if they're fun. And one of the things that helps them be fun is that they sort of get harder, sort of like a video game. You go up levels. And that actually makes them more effective, too. And you do that for about a month. So it's like half an hour, 5 days a week for a month is the time commitment. And, I mean, it's really unclear whether you need to continue this for a really long period of time and how long the effects last and all those things. But the studies have been based on about that amount of practice.
Listeners, we're talking about the emerging neuroscience of children and their brains and what playing brain games, such as keeping track of a color sequence in asteroids floating by on a screen, or having to add numbers together as they appear to you in real time in a game, what effect those games might have on how children learn and how it might improve their learning outcomes. We just heard Ingrid Wickelgren, editor at Scientific American Mind, who's written about this in a summer issue of that magazine. We heard her describe how there are certain logic games that have improved an aspect of learning, or an aspect of the brain called working memory. So I wonder, have you seen this maybe in yourself or your own kids? Do they play games, or do you play games to increase your brain's performance. Do you know if your kids are doing this kind of thing in school? And has it changed how they learn, what they learn, or how much they enjoy that they learn? What do we know about the brain that helps us understand the effect that games are having? And do you think this is something that maybe we ought to be seeing in schools across the board and not just for children who might suffer from learning disabilities and other disorders such as attention deficit hyperactivity disorder? What do you think? Call us at 1-800-423-8255. That's 800-423-TALK. You can also join us online at radioboston.org. Ingrid, hang on for just a second because I'd like to introduce one more guest into this conversation, and that is Allison Mackey. She's a researcher at MIT. Gabrielli Neuroscience Lab, and she is the MIT researcher we referenced at the beginning of the of this segment. Allison Mackey, welcome to Radio Boston.
Thank you.
So you did some studies about logic and reasoning games and their effect on a certain group of children. Describe to us who you were thinking of when you did the study and what the study entailed.
So we worked in a school that consistently didn't do very well on the California state test. And so we thought that this particular group of kids could stand to benefit the most from training their reasoning skills.
Right. And this is in Oakland, California.
This is in Oakland, yes.
And it's a lower socioeconomic school.
Right. And so in our group of kids, the average education of the mothers, which is a pretty good proxy, was about 10 years of schooling. So this is a very low income, low socioeconomic status group of kids. And so we thought we would introduce these new games that would tax their reasoning skills. And so what we thought was most important was that they were fun. I'm a neuroscientist by training, and when we think about how to get the biggest brain changes, we think about the chemical dopamine. And so fun can lead to dopamine release, which can lead to the most brain plasticity, the biggest brain changes.
Mm-hmm. So what game did you choose?
So the other thing about reasoning is that it's defined as a novel, the ability to solve novel problems. And so we actually chose about 15 games, and we changed them up very frequently. And so we never had them play a game for longer than about 15 minutes, which I think is really important when we're thinking about training this skill. And so we had a wide variety of inexpensive, commercially available games, some that were computerized and some that were not. Some of my favorites you'll probably recognize from the game store. They're made by ThinkFun. So I love the game Chocolate Fix. So you get these little plastic chocolate pieces and you have to put them in the box. You have to follow certain rules in order to arrange them in the box. So you'll have clues that will say something about the color or the shape of the chocolates. You have to put those pieces of information together to solve the problem. And that is very, very close to the kinds of tests that we use to measure intelligence.
Okay. And so you had the kids play these games, as you said, 15 minutes at a time. For how long every day?
So we structured, this was part of an after-school program, uh-huh. And so we structured 1 hour of 4 15-minute stations. Two were computerized, two were not, and we had them come in twice a week. So maybe they would come in Monday and Wednesday, and then at the same time, we had a separate group of kids playing games that improved processing speed, so the ability to take in information and have some sort of output. And this is also a really fundamental cognitive skill. And so those kids came in Tuesday, Thursday.
Okay. So basically twice a week for an hour each time over a period of 8 weeks,
exactly.
Is that right? So 16 hours total over 8 weeks.
Exactly.
Not that much terms of a time commitment.
Right.
And what did you see at the end of that period when you tested them on reasoning and other cognitive skills?
So the kids who had played the reasoning games actually showed a gain of about 30% on a measure of intelligence, of nonverbal intelligence. And that translates to about 10 points in IQ. And what we saw was also in the group who played those processing speed games, they showed about a 30% improvement as well.
Yeah.
And so we think that these skills can be trained specifically, and we don't think that any of the effects that we saw were due to just the general effects of interacting with researchers, of believing that you're in a brain-boosting program. And so we really do have some confidence that this kind of program can move reasoning
right.
ability.
So I have a couple questions for you on that. And Ingrid, feel free to jump in here as well, because I've heard both of you mention that there was an increase in IQ.
Yeah.
Now, how important or even valid is that of a measure in terms of, you know, increase of overall achievement? Because IQ is a pretty freighted concept
right.
as it is.
Right, and it can be defined in lots of different ways. So the measure we used was just one test of, it's called matrix reasoning, so putting together patterns of shapes, basically. And that ability predicts academic outcomes. So we don't know for sure that if we move the ability to solve these kinds of problems, that in the long term we'll see gains in academic performance, but those things are highly correlated.
Okay. And Ingrid, what about this question, jump in here about long-term academic achievement, because it is one thing to be tested, you know, in the time period near where you're playing the game, but thereafter, a semester or even a year later, does the increase, is it sustainable?
Right. I think that's one of the major outstanding questions here, and whether these brain changes are both large enough and sustainable enough to make a significant impact in achievement. Now, of course, achievement is based on all kinds of other things, like motivation, right? But for some children, I want to call it rate limiting factor, the problem that they need to overcome is, you know, in their thinking capacities. And so, right, the idea is let's give them the extra capacity and see if it can help. There have been short-term results on mathematical ability, but there still needs to be more work done. And my understanding is that Allison is planning on doing this as well to show whether you can produce long-term gains.
Are you, Allison?
We're working on that now. So I think this is a question where you need to have lots of kids involved in these kinds of programs to see whether the kids who improve the most just on the games and on the kind of cognitive measures right after training, if those kids show the biggest improvement in math and reading and these academic skills that we really care about. So that's very much a work in progress at MIT right now.
Listeners, we're talking about children and how they learn and how brain games could help them learn. I'm speaking with Ingrid Wickelgren. She's editor at Scientific American Mind, and she's written an article in that journal called Calisthenics for a Child's Mind. I'm also speaking with Allison Mackey. She's a researcher at MIT's Gabrielli Neuroscience Lab doing research on exactly this topic. We're at 1-800-423-8255. That's 800-423-TALK. Give us a call if you have kids or you have questions about games and learning and how it might change education as a whole, and if you think it should. Let's start with Jim, who's calling from Hyde Park. You're on the air, Jim.
Yes, thank you. Fascinating research you're doing, and it was just wonderful hearing all that you've done there. I have a 14-year-old that... He actually had a neuropsych exam, and I spent a lot of time arguing with the tester on the various things. That some of these tests date back to the 40s, it seems to me. And the research you're doing and others are doing just blows open a lot of notions that that they hold dear. And what can you do to bring this into the classroom faster?
Jim, thank you so much for your call. Ingrid, you've spoken with a lot of researchers across the board on this field and also have some information about the fact that it seems to be moving into schools, this idea that games can make a difference.
Yes. So some of these brain training programs are being marketed and sold by companies, and they have distribution in schools, and generally what's happening is that certain kids or sort of whole classrooms, if you're talking about the general population, are going to sort of a resource room for a period to try these games and work on their thinking skills. So, and speaking to the notion that that these programs and that these sort of capacities have long been thought to be fixed, and that you have to work around them and do the best you can. Yes, it is a fundamental sort of sea change in thinking, and so hopefully the trend will be that we'll get better research. There'll be more movement into schools. But a lot of these companies do have do have their software in a number of schools. There's a firm called Lumosity that also does a brain training workout that you can sign up for if you're a grown-up too. But their workouts are interesting because they cover a lot of these different bases. So many of the programs are very specific to working memory or reasoning or processing speed. But Lumosity, you can sort of do a lot of different ones, and they've had a pilot study on normal kids that have shown some effect as well.
Mm. Let's take another call. Elizabeth is calling from Acton. You're on the air, Elizabeth.
Hi. Thanks so much for taking the call. I'm a special ed teacher, and I'm also the parent of a child with autism, and I'm really interested in the research. But I'm curious if there's what you would recommend to someone just to try at home to boost these areas. I see firsthand how important they are and how closely they're tied to academic skills. And what can we sort of do as parents and educators now to help these skills along?
Elizabeth, thanks so much for your call. Allison Mackey, do you have any ideas for her?
I think a trip to the game store would be a lot of fun. And finding the games that kids enjoy and that they want to play, and especially for kids with a diagnosis like autism, that they would enjoy playing with another person. Because there you get the social interaction while boosting these fundamental skills.
Hmm. Allison, let me ask you a question, because earlier you said that you picked games which were fun.
Yes.
to maintain kids' attention and enthusiasm around them, and that, again, it was 15 minutes a time where they're at a station,
right.
so short period of time and enjoyable. I'm wondering, how much do you think those are just key factors in how anybody learns, and not necessarily sort of targeted learning games? Like, what if curricula were just changed in schools such that the idea that learning as a whole became a game? Like, what if you were learning Shakespeare as a game rather than having to sit there for 50 minutes straight and, you know, read the first act of Hamlet?
I think kids would be more engaged. I think they would learn more. There are people that will make the argument that it's really important to learn how to do boring, terrible things. And that's something that school should set you up for, because a lot of jobs are boring and terrible. And so practice with being gritty, with persevering through these difficult, boring sorts of lessons is really good for kids. And so I don't think we have the research base to say that we should make everything very fun, but I do think that that's probably the best way to get the brain to learn.
Mm. Ingrid Wickelgren, in your article, Calisthenics for a Child's Mind, while we've been talking about research that has shown measurable success in helping children learn or even changing their brains such that they become better learners, you also mentioned that in 2011 there was a meta-analysis done of six large studies that looked at a particular language-based game, I believe. And psychologist Charles Hume from the University of York, who did this meta-analysis, basically concluded that this language-based game had little effect on children's language or reading difficulties, and that results were mixed. So it doesn't seem as if the findings or conclusions are definitive as of yet.
Right. This particular language program was based on the very interesting hypothesis that dyslexia, reading difficulties, is based on an inability to tell apart different, very similar phonemes like da and ba in sort of in time. So you and then this program has since been sort of expanded to other types of training that's related to reading and understanding sentence structure and other things. So it's hard to generalize from a particular idea to all the other programs. I think everything has to be tested individually. And even this program, they sort of have this is the fast forward reading program. They've changed it up a bit and tried other things. So you're absolutely right. The jury is still out. And that's why I put that meta-analysis in there, because there are still open questions about a lot of these programs. And, you know, we don't know, but it's very interesting that that many of them are working on things that for many, many years psychologists have thought were fixed.
Well, Ingrid Wickelgren is editor at Scientific American Mind. She's written the article in that journal titled Calisthenics for a Child's Mind. There's a link to it at our website, radioboston.org. Ingrid Wickelgren, thank you so much for your time in opening our minds to this research.
Thank you for having me.
And Allison Mackey, researcher at MIT's Gabrielli Neuroscience Lab, one of the many people taking a look at how children learn through games. Allison Mackey, thank you so much for joining us.
Thank you.
And please come back when your next round of research is done. We'd love to learn how it's been going.
Definitely will. Thank you very much.
Okay. Thanks so much. And listeners, let us know what you think about games and kids and how they learn and your personal experience in any of that. Drop us a line at radioboston.org. Well, stick with us because coming up, a story of immigration, mining, and murder, and in the music of the Irish-American band Solas. Stay with us. I'm Meghna Chakrabarty with Anthony Brooks. This is Radio Boston.